Would you consider yourself an optimist or a pessimist? I know that I am in the pessimist camp. I want to be an optimist, but the longer you live, I think the more pessimistic you become. At least that's my experience at 72. The reason I begin with this is because I'm trying to figure out which example to give you. But I think that the biggest reason people don't choose to believe in the message of the gospel is because we have become so jaded by empty promises that turn out not to be true. It's interesting, I was looking earlier at the meaning of how the dictionary decided to define the phrase pie in the sky. And it's an interesting thing because I just scratched the surface. And it seems like we have a lot of ways of saying pie in the sky. What is it? I wouldn't get my hopes up. Hope springs eternal. And that's said in a kind of a cynical way. Yeah. In your dreams, you wish. Dream on. All of these are basically ways of saying an empty wish or a promise. Something that's good to think about, but extremely unlikely to occur. It's interesting because I think most of us are primed for disappointment. And I'm not sure that that is not correct. I mean, ultimately, you're going to die. And that is the ultimate. Now, I'm not talking about faith. Put that aside for a minute. But ultimately, I think many of you here, because a lot of us are here, are a little older. I think you may remember that song, "Is That All There Is?" Who was it by? Anybody remember? Who? Peggy Lee, yes. Peggy Lee. If you haven't heard that song, well, you might not want to hear it. It'll depress you. But she really does make a point. She says, basically the lyrics are, the chorus is that all there is, my friend? Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my friend, then let's keep dancing, let's count the booze and have a ball. And then she recounts three different scenarios of her life. When she was a little girl, she witnessed a house fire. And then she was taken to the circus. And she was all the clowns and all the animals. And after each of these verses, she could recount. She says, well, is that all there is to the circus? Or is that all there is to a fire? And then she says, and then I fell in love. Wonderful man, had a great life, but that too crashed. And then she sings, is that all there is to love? If that's all there is, then let's keep dancing. Let's break out the booze and have a ball. Then the last verse, it's really quite interesting. The last verse says, I know what you're thinking. If she feels that way, why doesn't she just end it all? And then I think actually she cops out, the song cops out, because she says, oh no, I'm not ready for that final disappointment. Because when I finally come to that final moment, I think what I'm going to be saying is that all there is to life? Now, you might be thinking right about now, Father, the wedding at Cana, why on God's green earth are you dealing with this? That's why I went to school. You see, the wedding at Cana is all about remedying disappointment. Disappointment is, you know, as I began my homily, it's all over the place in our songs, in our personalities. Ultimate disappointment is so much so that one of the world's major religions, Buddhism. In Buddhism, there's four noble truths. And in Buddhism, the four noble truths are that life is the first one. Life is mainly suffering. I don't know if you knew that. That's the first noble truth of Buddhism. And the goal of Buddhism is to overcome suffering, and that suffering is caused by desire and ignorance of reality's true nature, that we expect too much out of reality, and including the impermanence and the non-existence of the self. Buddhism answers this question by saying, yes, and the reason why is because you expect too much out of life. You should not have any expectations out of life. Renounce even the desire to be happy. And then you will then be able to resign yourself, and then you will end up in nirvana. Nirvana is when you have reached the lack of all desires. Now, folks, that couldn't be more opposite than to the message of the Christian faith. Today, look at what's happening. It's the beginning of Jesus' ministry. And in the beginning of Jesus' ministry, they go to a wedding. Now, please understand, Jewish weddings were not like ours. I mean, we consider our weddings lavish sometimes, but they last for maybe 4 hours, 5 hours, together with the reception and everything like that. In Jewish tradition, a wedding was a week long. People came from, people didn't have cars. And so if you were going to come to a wedding and you were going to travel 2 or 3 days to get to a wedding of a relative's, you weren't going to stay for 4 or 5 hours. You were going to be there for a week. Now, weddings were downright expensive. And the reason is that you had to feed and house all those people for a week. Okay? You think weddings are expensive now. And part of a wedding was the wine. In the ancient world, people did not drink water. They didn't drink water because water was constantly putrid, infected in all kinds of different diseases. And so the only thing you drank was wine. They mixed a little water into it so it wouldn't waste it, but the alcohol would kill the germs. And so you drank wine. And so Jesus, his mother, and his disciples were invited to this wedding. And Mary, probably about the third or fourth day or fifth day, I don't know, Mary comes up to Jesus and says, "They ran out of wine." Now, you have a lot of people waiting to have a party, and maybe it's day three or day four, or maybe by day six. But to run out of wine, you ran out of the party. And that's how, one of the things we know that Jesus was Catholic. By the way, if you don't know this, I have to, a little poem, a little ditty to share with you, but I have to share it with you, the final two words. The final two words are Benedicamus Domino, which in Latin means blessed be God. Benedicamus Domino. The little ditty goes like this. Wherever the Catholic sun doth shine, there's always laughter and good red wine. At least I've always heard it is so. Benedicamus Domino. But needless to say, let me get back to this. So Mary goes up to Jesus and says, "They have no wine." Now Jesus, it's an interesting context. What he says. He says, So what do you expect me? What has this got to do with you and me? They should have prepared better. The thing that always gets me about this gospel is, Mary doesn't even give him a response. Only a Jewish mother would do that. Did you notice in the gospel? In the gospel, what does that have to do with me? Jesus just spoken, and Mary ignores him and turns to the servants and says, "Do whatever he tells you." Okay? I wish I had that relationship with God, you know, do whatever he tells you. But then Jesus says, okay. Now, but just for you to have an aside of this, the gospel says there were 6 stone jars filled with water, or that were supposed to hold water, and they were held water for Jewish washing, because whenever you ate, you had to do a ritual kind of washing. Each of those stone jars held 30 gallons. 30 gallons. Now, Jesus said, "Fill the jars with water." That means there were 160 gallons of wine, of water. And Jesus, his first ministry, his first miracle is to produce 160 gallons of wine. Now, the moment that the steward tastes it, he's amazed because this is tremendous wine. And of course, he goes to the bridegroom and he says, "People use cheap wine first. Look what you have done. This is the best wine." Now, in the Gospel of John, John uses a lot of symbolism. And you've got to get used to understanding the symbolism of John. So the question would be interesting. Why did Jesus choose to do his first miracle making wine? The first time he shows his apostles his authority over reality. Why does he choose wine? And the answer is really because of the mission that Jesus has come to do. I'm always aware that if you were to ask Jesus, point blank, why did you come? Imagine you can have that, and you can just say to him, why did you come? And you know what his answer is directly from the Bible? Why did you come? He would say to you from, I think it's Luke 24. He says, I came that you may have life and have it in its fullness. Now, what does that mean? I want you to think about that statement. I came that you may have life and have it in its fullness. If he came that might happen, it means that we don't have it in its fullness, which is why I'm pessimistic, because I have always known that my desire for happiness far outstrips the reality of what I'm going to get. My desire for happiness, I don't want to be happy for a day. I don't want to be happy for a year. I want to be happy, and my hunger for happiness does not ever end. And the day that I am dying, I want to be happy still. I don't want to die. I want happiness that it goes on forever. But then people say, when you say I want happiness that lasts forever, people say, pie in the sky, Buster. Wouldn't get my hopes up. Hope springs eternal, Buster. Yeah, yeah, yeah. In your dreams, you wish. Dream on. Isn't that what we would say? Most of us would say that. I think that that's why we really want to believe Jesus and the resurrection and this whole talk about heaven. But part of us says, I don't know. I was thinking about that sentence, you know, that sentence that goes, I believe, help my unbelief. Now, what think about that. This person, whoever said that, it's in the Bible, had the experience of wanting to believe, but at the same time, inside, you're still going, dream on. Dream on. I believe. Help my unbelief. You see, the mission of Jesus is to come and overcome the basic sense of disappointment that we have with life. And make no mistake, left to our own devices, left to nothing, just without God coming to our rescue, Peggy Lee would have been right. Let's just keep dancing, break out the booze, and have a ball. Because you're going to die tomorrow. If that's all there is, my friend, that's all. But you see, the mission of Jesus is precisely to come and remedy that sense of disillusionment that we all have in life. Listen to the Old Testament, because, well, let me back up for a second here. The reason that Jesus chooses, because remember, Jesus doesn't do anything because he's pressured into it. The reason he chooses to make 160 gallons of wine is because in the Old Testament, Jesus is the bridegroom. The bridegroom is always God. And I don't know if you've heard it in the second reading. Your builder will marry you. And in the at the very end of time, the way that it is pictured, even in the book of Revelation, is that God takes Jerusalem as his bride. And so when God takes Jerusalem as his bride, there is what is called the Messianic banquet. And what the message of the Old Testament, the message of salvation, is actually that no matter how screwed up life is in this world, and no matter how much we have a temptation towards disappointment, and even when we're optimistic, optimism doesn't fly too well in the face of death. But even when we are pessimistic and optimistic and whatever it is, it's always limited in the face of death. But Jesus has come, and God has come to neutralize the very nature of why we are ultimately pessimistic. He has come to neutralize why Buddhism is correctly thinking that life is suffering. Because the ultimate suffering is the ultimate disappointment. Why did you live? Listen to the Old Testament right here. It's really interesting here. It says, the Lord of hosts will prepare a lavish banquet, a banquet of aged wine, choice pieces of meat with marrow, and refined aged wine. Do you know what Jesus is doing? He is actually saying that the age of the Messianic banquet has begun. Why the age of overcoming lack with plenty? Why do you remember when he fed the 5,000? They had bread and fish left over. He is saying that when God has come, humanity does not have to be pessimistic, because he has come to overcome the very nature of the world. Now, do you really believe that? I want to believe that. I've given my whole life to it. But it's typical to struggle with it. It's typical because it's such a big job. But that's what this is all about. The miracle of the wedding at Cana is all about helping us to come to believe that what we have most dreaded, that life is pointless, is actually untrue. That God has come to our rescue. He has come to rescue us. And I think that the only reason you might not want to believe this is because it's too good to be true. And I want to leave you understanding that that's the exact same way that the first disciples felt. The first disciples actually did not believe because it was too good to be true. Listen to this part from Luke chapter 24 in the resurrection. Jesus appears to the disciples, and the disciples are freaking out, and they think it's a spirit. And Jesus says to them, listen to this, see my hands and my feet? It is I, myself. Touch me. Touch me. And see, a spirit does not have flesh and bones. You see, I have that. And when he has said this, he showed them his hands and his feet. Now listen to the next sentence. to the reaction of the apostles. While they were still could not believe it, because of their joy and amazement, he said to them, "Do you have anything to eat?" What was the reason why they didn't believe it? It's too good to be true. While they still could not believe it, because of their joy and amazement. I think, folks, we are so programmed to being disappointed that even with our faith, we often say, "God, help me to believe that." But it's just almost too good to be true. And the wedding at Cana, what Jesus was beginning, all the signs that Jesus performs, is to help us to see that he has control over reality. He has control over all those things that ultimately leave you disappointed and disillusioned. That's why every time the gospel is preached, the priest says, "This is the gospel, the good news of the Lord." Folks, it is good news. It's just so good. I hope it's true. And it is. I have faith that it is.